ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we conclude a four-part series of a friendly conversation between skeptic Michael Shermer and Stephen C. Meyer on Meyer's book, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. We pick it up right as Meyer is turning the conversation from questions involving life in the universe to questions about the origin of the universe itself. And here again, the God Hypothesis proves itself to be very robust.
And that would be your same answer to the rebuttal. This is the way I put it. If the world is complex and looks intricately designed, therefore the best inference is that there must be an intelligent designer. By the same logic, we should infer that an intelligent designer must itself have been designed by a superior intelligent designer, and then a super-duper superior intelligent designer designed one.
These are logic chopping games that a lot of the... I mean, I really, you know, I don't know if you're quoting Carroll, because respect Carroll.
Reflecting a bunch. I think Dawkins made that argument too. A bunch of people have.
Yeah, that's Dawkins, who designed the designer objection. I addressed that in chapter 17 of Signature in the Cell in a really considerable detail. Short answer is every system of thought, every worldview or metaphysical system posits something as the thing from which everything else comes. Dawkins clearly posits matter and energy, and in the living context, a self-replicating system of molecules. You can ask Dawkins, what produced the replicator and what produced the matter and energy? His answer, and that of consistent philosophical materialists, has always been matter and energy, space and time, are eternal and self-existent. They play the same role in our system of thought that God plays in a theistic system of thought. So the real question is not what came before that philosophical primitive, because every system of thought has that problem. The question is, what is a better candidate to be that philosophical primitive, the prime reality from which everything else comes? I think the indicators we have of the finitude of the universe, that the universe had a beginning, and that the properties of the universe that are pointing to mind suggest that mind is a better ultimate explanatory principle than matter. I don't think matter scales up to mind. I do think minds shape matter.
So would an analogy be, this would be like trying to explain the origins of baseball, since you mentioned baseball in your book, and I love that section, because I was a big Cincinnati Reds fan. The big red machine with Johnny Bench, Pete Rose.
Well, that was Johnny Bench, Chuck Morgan. Those were the days.
But it would be like trying to explain the origins of baseball based on the rules that the game itself is played. You can't do that. This is a separate kind of explanatory mechanism.
Right. Exactly. What? Who set up the rules? The rules describe how the game is played, but there was a person. Naismith was to basketball what someone was to baseball, and I'm forgetting the.
It wasn't Doubleday. The legend was Doubleday, but it turns out. More complex than history with baseball. But would that not then apply to your using the concept of mind itself, since mind is part of the physical universe? However, it arises out of neurons firing. You're applying that to outside of the system.
Well, the great philosopher of mind, John Searle, gave a wonderful talk at that Baylor conference that you and I attended, where he showed that every single physicalist or even functionalist account of the origin of mind was able to cite, what he called them neurophysiological correlates, necessary conditions of the function of the mind. But in every case, he showed that there was a gap between necessity and sufficiency in the causal sense, that our physiological substrate, what's going on chemically in our brains and the way synapses are firing, those are absolutely necessary to proper function. But there's a difference between that and what our minds do when we are reasoning. And that gap is non-physical. My experience of red, or seeing you sometimes very clearly in Skype and then sometimes a little bit blurry because of probably the bandwidth issue, my experience of that, my conscious awareness of you, is fundamentally a different thing than whatever the physiological substrate is that makes that possible. And so... And my reasoning based on that imagery and the sounds and symbols that we're transmitting is something that is qualitatively different than the the physiological processes that make my brain function possible. So I'm a mind-body dualist. I'm not a simplistic Cartesian dualist. I'm a mind-body. I like the Eccles, Popper idea of
mind-body
interactionism.
Are you sure you're not a mind monist in which God is the mind and all of it derives from that one single source?
No, I know people who are Berkeleyan idealists who trend that way, but I think physical properties, and this is my, when I referred earlier to a biblical theology of nature, I think the physical world, physical entities have real causal powers. That's why I think it's completely legitimate to, for in, you know, vast swaths of scientific inquiry are concerned with how does one part of nature affect each other? Nature has real causal powers. But I also think that there is evidence in the structure of nature that mind played a role in its origin. And so I believe both things are real, mind and body, mind and matter.
My friend Deepak Chopra is a mind monist in the sense that you use Tillich's description.
Because Eastern world.
Yeah. You use Tillich's phrase, the ground of all being, which Deepak uses for consciousness. He says, there's nothing beneath consciousness. That is the ground of all being. And what you, Stephen Meyer, call God, I call consciousness. There's no conflict. We're talking about the same thing.
You speaking as
Deepak
Chopra or yourself?
Yeah. No, Deepak.
Yeah, okay, right. No, I mean, these are the great philosophical questions. There's basically, and I lay this out in the book, there's three basic, you know, classic worldviews. There's the mind before matter, roughly theism, deism. There's the matter before mind, which is the materialism view. And then there's the mind and matter are essentially one and the same, the pantheistic or panpsychic view, that comes out of the East. So, as someone who's teaches philosophy of science, this is a great discussion.
I know, it's a big one.
It's a great conversation.
Right? All right, let's go to another huge one, nothingness. So in my book, Giving the Devil His Due, it's just an essay collection. So I wrote an expanded version of my short article in Scientific American about nothing. So first of all, I mean, it's just such a weird concept. So here I'm quoting Robert Kuhn. He wrote a book with John Leslie called The Mystery of Existence. Why is there anything at all? So first, it's impossible to conceptualize nothing, no space, time, matter, light, darkness, or even conscious beings to perceive the nothingness. Here's Kuhn. Not just emptiness, not just blankness, and not just emptiness and blankness forever, but not even the existence of emptiness, and not even the meaning of blankness, and no forever. You know, at this point, I don't even know what I'm talking about. I mean, this is just, it's just like, what? Am I stoned?
Right.
You know, and so here, sometimes I feel like
you might be able to get your synapses around it, but you're not getting your mind around it.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's possible. And so I think, maybe if we had bigger brains or something, I don't know, but we're hitting an epistemological wall.
Well, here's something that I would love to commend to you at Skeptic Magazine as a topic to address. There's been this big push, and we alluded to this earlier, the idea that, in making a cosmological argument of the kind that I make, mine has a different form than the deductive argument of William Lane Craig. I use an inference to the best explanation sort of structure. People will come back and say, well, but do we absolutely know that the universe had an absolute beginning? We can't back extrapolate all the way because we've got general relativity only takes us back within Planck time. And I say, fair enough. There are also arguments for an absolute beginning based on special relativity that are geometric, that don't have energy conditions and don't depend on knowing what gravity was like in a quantum domain. So I think you can really justify the idea that there was a beginning. There's a physical extremity past which you can't go. But let's say you don't go with me that far. We have lots of indicators at the beginning, at least. The alternative approach to this is to say, yeah, we're going to try to characterize the beginning of the universe using some sort of quantum gravitational ideas. And so we'll come up with a quantum theory, a quantum gravity, a quantum cosmology. And the advocates of that, and this connects to the quotation you just read, people like Lawrence Krauss, who's popularized the work of Alexander Vilenkin or the Hawking-Hardy model, have essentially argued that we can explain the universe from nothing nothing except the laws of physics. The laws of physics that apply to the quantum gravitational era or epoch. Okay. But in the book, and this is, I think, one of the most significant original arguments in my new book, I argue that if that model of cosmological origins is true, it has its own tacit theistic implications. If you have a definite beginning and you develop a cosmological argument from that, you've got a God, you have a very strong God hypothesis. But if you don't like, if you say, let's not go with a definite beginning, let's say maybe we don't get a definite beginning, let's use quantum cosmological approaches, we're going to explain, and this is Krauss's claim on the cover of his book, Universe from Nothing. We've explained the origin from literally nothing, physical, but what ends up being the explanatory principle is what's called the universal wave function, the mathematical descriptions of all the possible universes that could emerge out of the singularity. So even in quantum cosmology, number one, there's still a singularity. There's still a beginning. It's presupposed in all the models. Whatever Hawking said in his popular books about imaginary time eliminating the singularity, it's still in his technical papers. I've read them, okay? Number two, the explanans, the thing doing the explaining of the origin of the universe, is a mathematical abstraction. It's a universal wave function, which is the solution to a big hairy equation called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is the analog to the classical Schrodinger equation in ordinary quantum mechanics. It's quite a trick to get a material universe of matter, space, time, and energy out of a pure mathematical expression. Are we really explaining the universe from nothing? Well, here's what Vilenkin has said about this, whom Krauss is popularizing. He's got a fascinating rhetorical question he raises at the end of Many Universes in One. And he says, before there was matter, space, time, and energy, what template were these laws, physical laws of quantum gravity or whatever, what template were they being written on? Because the laws of physics are things that we use to describe matter, space, time, and energy. They describe how matter interacts. They don't tell us where the universe came from. So if we have a realm of pure mathematics, knowing that math is conceptual and always exists in a mind, he says, are we really saying that a mind predates the universe? And so I've argued in the new book that quantum cosmology, if true, is the alternative to the straightforward extrapolation back to an absolute beginning. If it is true, it has its own theistic implications because it implies mind before matter. And furthermore, and this is the even deeper thing, it turns out that to get that universal wave function, which functions as the explanatory principle in quantum cosmology, psi, you know, the famous expression from quantum mechanics, applied to the early universe, that psi is a purely mathematical reality, but you only get a psi that includes our universe, which is a condition of explanation on this model. You only get such a psi function if you solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is a functional differential equation that has an infinite number of solutions unless very restrictive boundary constraints are applied to it. But there's no physical system yet. There's no physical universe to describe that you're describing. So there's nothing in the physics that can help you specify the boundary constraints. So where do they come from? They're chosen by the theoretical physicists with an end goal in mind, namely getting a psi function out that includes a universe like ours that matches our physics. So this is entirely teleologically, it's a modeling that's entirely teleological, and it requires an input of information from the theoretical physicists into the mathematical apparatus that models the origin of the universe. And that I contend, is a form of intelligent design. It's just like the simulation experiments that the original life researchers do, where you've got massive investigator interference.
Would that be different than Max Tegmark's idea of the mathematical universe, the whole thing at bottom, pure mathematics?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I just described was chapter 18 in my book. What you just asked about is chapter 19.
Perfect.
Tegmark takes the multiverse one better and says that every mathematically possible structure is instantiated in some possible world, okay? And that would allow you to circumvent the argument I'm making now about the need for inputs of information, because you just say that every possible solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation was one of those mathematical structures that existed in some possible world. So that is the one way, that is the atheist way out of the cosmological argument, but it comes at a huge cost, Michael. And that is that if you accept that every mathematical structure that is possible exists in some possible world, You can have very idiosyncratic laws in which things are regular for a long period of time, and then something completely irregular occurs. Polanyi made the great observation that through any finite set of points, you can draw an infinite number of curves. So you essentially end up with a complete, we could be living in a universe that has looked completely regular in its basic law-like structure till right now, and then we will have could have an episodic random quantum fluctuation, or just we might have laws that describe highly irregular curves and phenomena, cause and effect relationships. It completely destroys the possibility of reliable prediction or explanation. You get Boltzmann brain problems. And so these infinite universe cosmologies, which are necessary to circumvent cosmological arguments, are possible ways of viewing things, but they come at the cost of a complete destruction in any reasonable confidence in the reliability of the mind. In other words, you can get rid of the God argument, but only at the cost of science. My argument is that science points to God, but you can circumvent the arguments from science to God, but only at the cost of destroying science. You end up with epistemological chaos. And that's, I look at the Boltzmann brain problem, and the complete inability on a Tegmarkian view of things to make either to have reliable scientific explanation or prediction.
This is getting heavy. Sometimes I feel like Marty McFly in Back to the Future. English doc.
Hey,
all right.
Hey, and maybe we should do one last thing, because we've been at it an hour and 45. I might be wearing you out. And
I was going to give you one last challenge here. This comes from Leslie and Kuhn's book, The Mystery of Existence. In Kuhn's Taxonomy of Nothings, he lists what categories of things might be included in something that would be negated by nothing. These include physical, mental, platonic, spiritual, and God. Physical, all matter, energy, space, and time, and all the laws and principles that govern them, known and unknown. Mental, all kinds of consciousness and awareness, known and unknown. Platonic, all forms of abstract objects, numbers, logic, forms, propositions, possibilities, again, known and unknown. Spiritual and God, anything that could possibly fit this non-physical category, all forms of religious and spiritual belief. If by nothing is meant no physical objects or matter of any kind, for example, there could still be energy from which matter may arise by natural forces guided by the laws of nature. Physicists, for example, talk about empty space as seething with virtual particles from which particle-antiparticle pairs come into existence as a consequence of the uncertainty principle of quantum physics.
Yeah, or scalar fields. Exactly. Yeah.
But if by nothing
that's not really nothing in the philosophical.
That's right.
Sense.
But here,
something.
To the point.
Yeah.
But if by nothing is meant also no physical, mental, platonic, or non-physical entity of any kind, then there can be no God or gods, which means there cannot be anything outside of nothing out of which to create something. So how does that square with your model?
You're making my head hurt, too. But, cue to some of the considerations that I develop in the book here. The quantum cosmologists, at least in their popularizations, will say that they've explained the universe from nothing. But their nothing is either pre-existing space with an energy field that is unexplained, or it's, if you push it back further, a quantum mechanical wave function, a universal wave function that describes what they call superspace, all the possible universes with various gravitational fields. And then a mathematical apparatus that allows you to justify the existence of such a mathematical entity. So in quantum cosmology, it's not it's either pre-existing space with energy, which is not nothing, or it's pre-existing mathematical reality, which is platonic and I would argue theistic, because in our experience, ideas don't exist disembodied; they exist in minds. Minds think ideas, so. If they're really saying that the universe came out of math, then I think Vilenkin is right in his. Vilenkin never answered his own rhetorical question, but he raised a very provocative question, which is: are we really then saying that the universe came out of a mind? It seems to be implied in the idea that math precedes matter. And Hawking himself tumbled to this when he said, "What puts fire in the equations that gives us a universe to describe?" Hawking was the classic God-obsessed atheist, and And I mean that as a compliment. He was taking these things very seriously and didn't want the God hypothesis to be true, but also was wrestling from the time he proved the singularity theorem to the end of his life in developing cosmological models that would, he hoped, make the God hypothesis unnecessary. I think ultimately he failed, but I applaud the struggle. He was quite an interesting figure.
I recommend you read Leonard Mlodinow's book, Stephen Hawking, A Memoir. He talks about that, and I think this is going to be one of these enduring conversations. You know, what did Einstein really say about God? What did Hawking really mean about God? But here's Leonard's take, because he knew Hawking pretty well. They wrote the grand design together.
Right?
They wrote two books together. So anyway, in the epilogue, he opens with, Bantam published The Grand Design. Here it is. In September 2010, on the morning of September 2nd, I was walking my daughter Olivia to school when my cell phone rang. It was Judith, just Hawking's assistant there. And she was agitated. Leonard, she shouted, we need your help. I have no idea what she was talking about. Haven't you seen the Times? She asked. The New York Times, I said. Yes, I'd read it. No, not the New York Times, the London Times. Haven't you seen it? Judith, who reads the London Times here in L.A.? Well, Google it and look at the headline. It says, quote, Hawking, colon, God did not create the universe. It's creating a furor. Well, the press is all over, and then Leonard continues, that's wrong. We said God isn't necessary for creating the universe. Not that physics proves he didn't. Well, the press is all over it, and Stephen can't handle it all. We need your help. You know, so he ended up fending off all these things. No, we're not saying that. We're not saying we prove there's no God or anything like that. Just that it's not necessary.
Well, I did find a disparity between Hawking's popular work in The Brief History of Time. I was a wet behind the ears grad student and got to attend some of the lectures upon which that popular book was based when I was in Cambridge. So I've been interested in this quantum cosmological stuff for a long time, but I have recently revisited it. And, you know, he claims that he does this mathematical transformation called a Wick rotation on the space depiction of space-time mathematically. And in an intermediate step in that depiction, you what they call spatialized time, and time is a variable, drops out as you're in the domain of complex numbers. And so the depiction of the universe looks like it has no definite beginning. But he acknowledges that that depiction has no physical significance. But in that famous statement that the British press and others, worldwide press, jumped on, you know, what need then for a creator? You know, if there's no beginning, then what need then for a creator? And he almost characterized it this way in his more honest moments, just saying that this was a kind of mathematical trick. That's what he said. It was a mathematical trick. It had no physical meaning. Therefore, you can't really draw a metaphysical implication from a mathematical expression that has no physical meaning. He acknowledged that when you transform back into the domain of real numbers, that the singularity reappears. And it's presupposed in all his technical papers with Hartle on quantum cosmology. So so I can understand the way the misunderstanding arose. Of course, my argument is that it's not just that the God hypothesis is not necessary. I actually argue that quantum cosmology, Hawking's own research program here with Hartle, has tacit or latent implications that suggest the necessity of a God hypothesis, the explanatory necessity of a God hypothesis, that if you're actually having to constrain possibility space to get your mathematical apparatus to produce a universal wave function that includes a universe like ours, then you are actually modeling the need for an input of information in order to generate a universe like ours. And so therefore, even if you can get matter and energy out of math alone, you can't get the information needed to produce a universe like ours without mind. So I think if quantum cosmology is true, it has implications that are theistic and every bit as powerfully theistic as a straightforward Kalam argument of the type that William Lane Craig makes.
Could be, he was just being also a little playful, because Leonard's got another story about the sentence in the grand, I think it was in the Grand Design, where they said something like philosophy is dead, or philosophers have, you know, haven't done anything in ages. And Leonard said, Stephen, we can't say that. That's not true. And so then Leonard says, I brought in a bunch of philosophy of science books and started going through them. And I wrote this like paragraph long sentence about the proper way to say it. And Stephen said, your sentence has no punch. We're going with mine.
It has no punch. Yeah. Well, they wrote a popular book, and fair enough. You know, fair enough.
Yeah.
That's the,
So it could be he's looking for
the
punchiness.
The fun thing about Hawking did have a twinkle about him, you know, yeah, and he had a wit that came through even through the voice synthesizer. So I think what I did in the new book is develop what philosophers call a robust argument, showing that if you can take several different things as the factual predicate, and you'll end up with the same conclusion. So if you assume that as best we can tell, the universe had a beginning, the best explanation of the beginning is something like a transcendent intelligence, theism or deism. If you say, well, we can't be absolutely sure there was a beginning, we need a quantum cosmological model of the origin of the universe, then I show you have theistic implications for other reasons. Although even in those models, they still presuppose the singularity. So, and the only reason not to accept that there was a beginning was that we might have this very small era of time inside Planck time, an epoch of quantum gravity. And so if you run with quantum gravity, you end up with all the difficulties I just described of a universal way, matter coming out of math, and the need for information to make the math describe a universe like ours, which is coming out of a mind in all the modeling.
All right, Stephen, we're pushing up on 2 hours. Let me just close with this. Close with this. If I'm right, we'll never know. If you're right, we will find out in the next life, and I'll get to apologize. And hopefully, we'll be in the same place.
Well, no apologies will be needed. We'll sit down
continue the conversation.
We'll have an infinitely long conversation. Right on.
We'll ask the mind, why didn't you give us more evidence? No, just kidding. All right, Stephen, we will continue the conversation when the next book comes out, probably on consciousness and morality or something like that.
Thank you for this, and congrats on your new book, which I understand is just come out? Or
No. Well, this was my essay collections, which is a year now. A paperback comes out pretty soon, and then the next big book is on conspiracies. Conspiracies and conspiracy theories is another topic that has kind of risen to the top of the news cycle.
Yes,
so,
indeed.
Yeah, indeed.
I understand.
All right. Congratulations again.
All right.
In fact, I forgot to endorse this at the beginning.
Such a deep conversation.
The way I say it is, if you want to read one single book that best summarizes intelligent design theory, this is it. You capture all the major arguments and all the latest stuff that's been worked out in the last few decades. So good job. We'll see you next time.
You too, friend. Yeah. We'll hope we connect in person before too long as things open up.
That was Stephen C. Meyer speaking with skeptic Michael Shermer in the last of 4 episodes originally hosted on Shermer's podcast channel. They've been talking about Meyer's book, Return of the God Hypothesis, 3 scientific discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe. It's available at all online booksellers. Please stay tuned to ID the Future at your favorite podcast app, and if you find these conversations compelling, please give them a positive rating and please tell a friend, too. For ID of the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.